Welcome to this Audio Digest edition of the Herald Scotland. From Friday the 17th to Thursday the 23rd of August 2018. Read by volunteers at Cune Review Prince Meeting to the Blind at our studios in the Bishopriggs Media Centre. The headlines in part 1.
Hoot SBC Scotland Chief Executive Alison McGregor quits and will not be replaced.
McFarland to begin work with Ulster immediately.
Fans take High Road for last run with gigs.
Nicola Sturgeon admits to worrying about contributing to woes of world.
Scottish Secretary David Mundell tells warring Tory factions to unite around Brexit plan. Herald Scotland Online.
Ian McWhirter. Nigel Farage, the Brexit stalking horse for Boris Johnson in Tory leadership bid.
What wins prestigious poetry award? 50p tickets for citizens at tramway. Award for reading champions open.
Jers, Scotland's finances in first year of independence would have been worse than previously thought. Very Scottish Suleiman Coulibaly comes home sweet home with Partick Thistle.
This is an article from the Herald, written by senior news reporter Brian Donnelly, 17th of August 2018. Hoot SBC Scotland Chief Executive Alison McGregor quits and will not be replaced. Hoot SBC Scotland Chief Executive Alison McGregor has quit the role and will not be replaced in a move that has been linked to the implementation of new regulations on the ring-fencing of banking operations. The decision not to take on a new chief executive was made after Ms McGregor said she would leave the Glasgow-based post at the end of the year to pursue a portfolio of non-executive directorships, the bank said, and it is connected to structural changes made as a result of the new industry regulations ring-fencing the public from risky investments. HSBC UK insisted the move not to replace McGregor would not undermine its ambitions for growth in Scotland, and in the senior management team would steer the operation and more time will be dedicated collectively. Ms McGregor said in a statement on Professional Network linked, in, after four fantastic years leading HSBC Scotland, I have made the decision to embark on a new chapter. This has not been an easy decision to make, but I am excited to take a new career path of building a portfolio of non-executive directorships. When I was appointed into the role, my aims were to raise the profile of HSBC in Scotland and maximise the opportunity for growth. Alongside lovely and capable people, we have achieved that, seeing revenue growth across the business. Our team in Scotland have expanded, and we now employ over 4,000 people across a number of disciplines and brands. I am proud of what we have achieved together. Ms McGregor joined from Clydeside Bank at a time when HSBC invested £10 million in cooperative and commercial banking centres in Glasgow, Edinburgh and Aberdeen. Staff numbers have gone from 3,200 to 4,000 during Ms McGregor's time in the post. A former chairman of CBI Scotland, she also said, HSBC Scotland plays a significant role in supporting the growth of Scotland, and I have been immensely honoured to lead this great business. I am pleased to confirm that HSBC's UK strategy of growth in Scotland is unchanged, remaining fully committed to our Scottish customers and stakeholders. By utilising the vast experience and contrast we have within our senior management team, ensuring that different areas of the bank are represented more time will be dedicated collectively to raising the bank's profile and growing our market share in Scotland. I wish my colleagues well and will always be a proud supporter of HSBC Scotland. From January next year, the largest UK banks must separate or ring-fence core retail banking from investment banking to protect the public from so-called casino banking. But preparation has cost banks like HSBC and RBS billions. A spokesman for HSBC UK said, as Alison's message says, our strategy and appropriate growth in Scotland remains unchanged. But in light of Alison's decision to embark on a new chapter in her career, we looked at the shape of the senior roles and responsibilities, taking into account structural changes brought about as a result of ring-fencing of HSBC UK. We are fully committed to our Scottish businesses and to growing our market share, and we believe we can best serve our Scottish customers and stakeholders by utilising the vast experience and contracts we have within our Scottish leadership group, practically our retail bank, commercial bank and non-ring-fenced bank, working together to dedicate more time collectively to raising our profile and growing our market share in Scotland. This was an article written by Senior News reporter Brian Donnelly.
Here at Q&A Review, we're always looking for more volunteer presenters, producers and sound technicians to volunteer with us and help produce our daily talking newspapers for the blind. If you're interested, please leave a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976 or email us at information@qandreview.com.
The Herald, Monday, August the 20th. Sport, rugby. McFarland to begin work with Ulster immediately. Compensation may also have been involved, but common sense has finally prevailed with Scottish Rugby's agreement to release Dan McFarland to begin work at Ulster ahead of the new season. The Englishman, who has worked as forwards coach under Gregor Townsend at Glasgow Warriors, then Scotland, over the past 3 years, was appointed to the role of head coach at the Irish province back in April, but Murrayfield has insisted since then that he would be held to the terms of his contract for 9 months until the beginning of next year. Soon afterwards, Townsend made the strange-looking appointment of fellow borderer Carol Hogg as an additional forwards coach on the summer tour of the Americas, which was perceived as a trial run as a possible replacement following his departure from the head coach's post at Worcester Warriors a few months earlier, even though McFarland was still part of the management team. Scotland recorded expected wins over Canada and Argentina on that trip, but suffered one of its biggest ever shock defeats to the world number 15 ranked USA. And while Hogg was thanked for his efforts, it was announced while the team was still abroad that Danny Wilson would be joining Scotland as a forwards coach, in turn causing major problems for English Premiership club Wasps, who thought they had agreed terms to recruit the man who led the Cardiff Blues to their European Challenge Cup win last season. While Ireland Rugby Football Union, IRFU, Performance Director David Nusifora stated back in June that he was confident matters would be resolved well before January and that they remained hopeful that McFarland would be at the province in time for the new season, Ulster were forced, in seeking to prepare their squad for the coming season, to bring in Simon Easterby, the former Ireland flanker, Scarlets head coach and Ireland forwards coach, as an interim head coach while, it seems, Scottish Rugby continued to negotiate with their Irish counterparts. Matters have finally been resolved, however, with Ulster announcing yesterday that the Irish Rugby Football Union and Scottish Rugby have reached an agreement to allow Dan McFarland to begin working with Ulster Rugby tomorrow, Monday. The parties reached a mutual agreement on terms this weekend, allowing Dan to take up his new role as head coach of Ulster. For their part, Scottish Rugby noted that McFarland, who joined the Scotland coaching team from Glasgow Warriors in 2017, was announced as Ulster head coach in April, but was contractually obliged to remain in post for a 9-month notice period ending in January, having originally signed a deal to the summer of 2019. The governing body and Guinness Pro 14 side have, however, reached a mutual agreement on terms to allow him to take up his new role immediately. That should, in turn, also make matters less complicated for Wilson, allowing everyone to get on with the jobs that they want to be doing.
The Herald Scotland. Arts. recorded on the 17th of August 2018. Fans take High Road for last runway gigs. By Chief Reporter David Leask. A few will take the high road, a few will take the low, and many more will break their bonnie banks to do so. Tens of thousands of fans are this weekend making one last pilgrimage to hear Runrig play Loch Lomond. For they and their true loves, as the band's floor-filling cover nearly goes, will never meet again. The six-piece has sold 47,000 tickets for farewell concerts in Stirling today and tomorrow, and that will bring down the curtain on 45 years of their groundbreaking band of Celtic folk rock. Their fans, many in the Hebrides, have struggled to afford or arrange the journey with Calmac, warning ferries were full and extra flights from the island put on to cater for extra demand. Against the backdrop of Stirling Castle, Runrig will perform for just two last times. What a mount soundtrack of the last few turbulent decades of Scottish history. Through two devolution referendums and 2014's big vote. The group, despite some changed faces, says it has a special bond with its fans, many of whom were enjoying rock in their own language for the first time. But the time, the musician said, had come to bow out. Vocalist Bruce Guffrow said, "I think we're ready. I think we're very proud of what we've accomplished, and we're ready to give Scotland the show of a lifetime." The Canadian, who has been touring with Runrig for 20 years, said of his time with the group, "All of it has been special. It's almost impossible to pick certain highlights. It's just been a great journey." The fans are a family unto themselves, and they are without question the driving force behind this band. Since forming on Sky in 1973, Runrig have produced 14 studio albums and performed at Edinburgh Castle, the Royal Albert Hall, and in New York's Times Square. They are hailed for their contribution to Scottish music, the Gaelic language, and Scotland's cultural identity. No, they were never entirely happy to be seen as a kitsch symbol of Scottishness. Founding member Rory McDonald said it is a love of performing that has kept the group going through the decades. The bass player said, "We've tended just to go from album to album. We've never had a grand plan or the idea that we're going to take over the world. None of that stuff." Very early on, maybe after the third album, we knew very much that this was what we wanted to do with our lives. It wasn't for fame or fortune. It was just that we loved playing music and playing together. We've always had the sense of being comfortable with what we're doing. That's the way it has worked for us. Guitarist Malcolm Jones added, "If you'd said then that 45 years later we'd still be doing this, you'd have thought no way, not a chance." Jones said concerts, called Last Dance, marked the end of an era for the band, but other projects would continue, including looking after the group's legacy. Keyboard player Brian Hearn admitted there has been nerves ahead of the final concert. He said, "I would say it's unlike any other show I've experienced with the band. I've had sleepless nights, and I've had elation and excitement, sadness, everything. It's been an incredible journey." There are a lot of fans who can't get to see us because they're in Australia or places that are just too far away. But they have been trying to make it over for this show, which is amazing. Meeting the band ahead of the concerts, Scotland's Deputy First Minister John Swinney thanked Runrig for their extraordinary contribution to Scotland's cultural life. He tweeted, "A very special privilege to thank Runrig 1973 on behalf of Scottish Government for all they have done to strengthen Scottish traditional music, the Gaelic language, and Scotland in 45 years of amazing music. They have been such an important part of Scotland's incredible journey." Mr. Swinney's SNP colleague, Pete Wishart, MP, formerly played keyboards for the band. Mr. Wishart has said he would never join the SNP when interviewed in 1991. Speaking to writer Peter Ross in last weekend's Herald magazine, Mr. Wishart stressed the band's part in helping Scotland learning to love and appreciate a sense of itself as confident and assertive. He added, "All the other political changes could never have happened without a feeling that what we have in Scotland is important and worth celebrating." The band did not write Loch Lomond, but the traditional song's lyrics may offer some consolation. "The broken heart it kens, nae second spring again," it goes, "no the waeful may cease free their grieving." By Chief Reporter David Leask.
Remember, this programme is just a fraction of what we produce. You can access more daily content online via our website, qnreview.com/freepodcasts, for free daily podcasts of the Evening Times and Herald Scotland newspapers, weekly digests of the National newspaper, and weekly full readings of Inside Soap magazine. Now, back to the main programme.
Article from Herald Scotland, 21st of August, 2018. News. Nicola Sturgeon admits to worrying about contributing to woes of world. Nicola Sturgeon has admitted she and other politicians cause divisions in society, dumb down public debate and push people into taking sides. The First Minister also described the world as often a dark and worrying place at present. Ms Sturgeon made the comments at the Edinburgh International Book Festival while hosting a talk with the novelist Ali Smith, whom she called Scotland's greatest living writer. The First Minister was reflecting after reading a passage from Ms Smith's recent novel Autumn about the divisions in society left by the EU referendum and Brexit. Ms Sturgeon, who is due to make an announcement on a second independence referendum in October, said, "As a politician, I'm acutely aware, and it's something I think about a lot, that politicians, by definition, are opinionated. We put forward strong views and policies. We're sometimes the cause, or a cause, of the division. Also, how we communicate now seems to reinforce those divisions. It pushes people to take sides and simplify things." Although Ms Sturgeon mostly put the questions to Ms Smith, the author also asked the First Minister, a voracious reader, what happened when she read a book. Ms Sturgeon said, "A whole variety of different things. Sometimes the ability to escape and switch off from whatever it is that's worrying me at the time. If there was one thing I could make compulsory for leaders across the world, it would be to read fiction. For me, fiction, much more than non-fiction, allows situations that I have no direct experience of to be really conjured up and for me to develop an understanding in a way that is different from reading non-fiction." After Ms. Smith referred to President Trump and political lying, Ms. Sturgeon said most people would recognise the world, to some extent, as a dark place just now, a worrying place. Ms. Smith also told Ms. Sturgeon that art is needed now more than ever to breach the political divides of Brexit. The author of the acclaimed Autumn and Winter, two books from a planned quartet of contemporary novels, told Nicola Sturgeon that the art form could be a unifying force in the face of division. The two were speaking in conversation at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, where Ms Sturgeon acknowledged that politicians were often the cause of such division. She said, "As a politician, I'm acutely aware, and it's something I think about a lot, that politicians, by definition, we're opinionated. We put forward strong views on politics. We're sometimes the cause, or a cause, of the division. Also, how we communicate now seems to reinforce those divisions. It pushes people to take sides and simplify things. Is there a case right now that either through the form of the novel or the perspective of the writer, that perspective is actually much more needed, perhaps now, than it has been in our lifetimes?" Ms. Smith responded, "The novel is a unifying force. All art reminds us to engage, and it reminds us to enter, even just with itself, dialogue. Dialogue is the source of life. The point at which you actually talk to somebody, rather than block a story, that's coming from someone else, the point at which the stories meet and become one story instead of separate stories on competing sides of the walls and fences, which politics across the world at the moment is just not threatening us with, but building." Ms. Smith said, "This was the darkest time that I've ever lived in," adding, "In our lives, across the world, from this country outward, from the UK outwards, it's a dark, dark premise. With nobody interested in the UK government in those splits, to try to heal the thing that is revealed by Brexit. Everybody vying for power in a way that is absolutely terrifying." But she told the First Minister, who said most would recognise to some extent the current time as a dark place, a worrying place, that the novel was ultimately a form that gave hope for the future. Nick Barley, book festival director, provoked laughter when he thanked Ms Sturgeon for being a Prime Minister who reads, before correcting it to First Minister.
Scottish Secretary David Mundell tells warring Tory factions to unite around Brexit plan. Herald Scotland Online, Tuesday the 21st of August 2018. Scottish Secretary David Mundell has urged warring Tory Brexiteers and Remainers to unite and rally round the Prime Minister's Chequers plan. The minister, who is the only member of David Cameron's 2015 cabinet still in his original post, warned that the increasingly polarised positions of the factions are not generally acceptable to the wider public. Mr Mundell, who made the intervention ahead of Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab's resumption of negotiations in Brussels, told news website Politico that there is no alternative to Theresa May's plan. Speaking to Politico's morning newsletter, Playbook, he said, "People have to wake up to what the alternatives are. I think people have to be challenged. If they don't like the Chequers deal, what is their alternative?" He added, "Clearly there is a group of people who would just leave the EU at any cost in any circumstances. And there is another group of people who would go back into the EU. Neither of those alternatives, I think, are generally acceptable to the wider public, nor would be of benefit now to the country. I think there is a growing reality that, other than extreme positions, there isn't an alternative."
From the Herald, 22nd of August 2018, from the politics section, Ian McWhirter. Nigel Farage, the Brexit stalking horse for Boris Johnson in Tory leadership bid, by Ian McWhirter. Trust Nigel Farage to be first out of the charts for the new political season. He's going back on the road as chairman of the hard Brexit campaign, Leave Means Leave, dedicated to exposing Theresa the appeaser and the elite of cowardly Remainers who are doing their best to frustrate the will of the people by delaying Article 50. I know that I could be accused of helping the Farage cult by writing about him. My excuse is that he has little appeal north of the border and that his battle bus will almost certainly avoid touring Scotland. So why write about him at all if he is politically irrelevant? Mr Farage is relevant precisely because of the magnetic pull he's likely to exert on the UK Tory leadership, the contest for which effectively begins at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham next month. He is also relevant because he is right about at least two things. First, that Theresa May's Chequers plan for a facilitated customs partnership is dead. It is regarded as treachery by most Tories and has, anyway, been rejected by Brussels. He is also right that, under Mrs May, free movement will never end. The UK government has looked at trying to reduce EU immigration by 80% and realised that it can't be done without causing a massive headache for business. The Civil Service and the Migration Advisory Committee will come up with a Labour mobility framework, which will largely reproduce the present arrangement, under which EU workers have a right to reside for 3 months. This, of course, is a good thing, especially for Scotland, where migrant workers are necessary to run the NHS and help pay for costly social care. The reality is that EU migration is already dropping like a demographic stone. Net migration from EU countries is now lower than net migration from non-EU countries in Latin America, Asia, the Middle East and so on. This may not please racially purist members of UKIP once they catch on. However, the Prime Minister's imminent equivocation on free movement will fuel Brexiter paranoia about global companies forcing the UK government to defy the people in order to keep their pull of cheap labour. The Farageists will target pro-immigration Tory Remainiacs and their supposed Soros financed backers who are trying to keep Britain in the European single market. Not just the people's voters like the ubiquitous Lord Adonis, but anyone who isn't a supporter of a no-deal, cliff-edge Brexit. Aware of the dangers of Mr Farage's influence, senior Tories like former leader William Hague and junior ones like Paul Masterton MP are warning of entryism, claiming that the Kippers are trying to do a momentum and swamp dozy Tory constituent parties with eager beaver Brexiteers. Apparently, Tory membership has grown in the last 12 months from around 120,000 to nearly 200,000, presumably due to an influx of anti-Europeans who don't trust Mrs. May. This is why Mr. Farage doesn't need to join the Tory party. It has already largely been remade in his image. The Blue Trots are now mobilising to change the method of electing the Tory leader, which is widely seen as an establishment stitch-up. Ordinary members are only allowed to choose from the two candidates that the parliamentary party, through the 1922 committee, allows them to vote on. John Strafford of the Campaign for Conservative Democracy wants any candidate who wins the support of 20 MPs to be able to stand in a multi-candidate contest. And who is the figure most likely to benefit? Alexander Boris de Feffo Johnson. He's the most popular figure with Brexit Tories and is most likely to gravitate to the lower Tory leadership if they have their way. He's also loathed by most Tory MPs, some of whom, like former Attorney General Dominic Grieve, say they would leave the party if he became leader. It may come to that. The prospect of Mr. Johnson on the threshold of number 10 will appeal to many readers and would be a disaster for the Scottish Tory leader, Ruth Davidson. Mr. Johnson himself may not even be too keen on the idea of becoming leader. He must know that leading the Conservative Party is a poison chalice, and whoever is in charge in the coming years of transitional chaos will probably be condemned by history. But some have leadership thrust upon them. No one else in the Tory cabinet has Mr. Johnson's recognition and popularity amongst Brexiteers. Jacob Rees-Mogg is too conspicuously privileged and awkward. Michael Gove is a busted flush, as is David Davis, who failed as Brexit Secretary. Home Secretary Saeed Javid is carving out a position as a pro-Israeli Muslim, tough on crime, but he's only been an MP since 2010. Meanwhile, Mr. Johnson scored a major victory in the eyes of the right this summer by refusing to apologise for his remarks about the burqa. This has attracted a lot of racists to his website, but it has also attracted a lot of non-racists who feel oppressed by political correctness. It may surprise readers, but in London many people still think of Mr. Johnson as a liberal. When he was mayor, he applauded diversity, called for an amnesty for illegal immigrants, supported gay pride and promoted cycling. He also admitted to having taken cannabis and cocaine when a student. Unlike the vast majority of politicians, he has a personality. He stands out, often for the wrong reasons, but he cannot be ignored. Nothing is certain in this maelstrom of Brexit politics, and it would be daft to predict who will be the next Tory leader. But there is widespread recognition that Mrs. May is finished. The Tory membership loathed her Chequers plan, her leadership skills are poor, and she has no loyal power base. The only reason she's still there is to take blame for the chaos of Brexit. Even if she succeeds in winning a deal with Brussels in October, she will be condemned as a traitor. Her departure is only a matter of time. Mr. Farage is holding the clock while Mr. Johnson gazes in the mirror. And that was by Ian McWhirter.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 23rd of August. Arts. Arts news. Watt wins prestigious poetry award. 50p tickets for citizens at tramway. Award for reading champions open. This article by Phil Miller. Roseanne Watt has won the Edwin Morgan Poetry Award. It was announced last night. She is the third poet to win an award set up by the late Macker Edwin Morgan to support poets who are 30 years of age and under. With an award of £20,000, the Edwin Morgan Poetry Award is one of the largest literary prizes in the UK. Ms. Watt is a poet, filmmaker and musician from Shetland. She is poetry editor from the online literary magazine The Island Review and was the winner of the 2015 Outspoken Poetry Prize, Poetry and Film, and runner-up in the 2018 Aesthetica Creative Writing Award. She lives and works in Edinburgh. The judges were novelist Janice Galloway and poet John Glenday. Ms. Galloway said of Watt that her poems are built from the sight, sound and heartbeat of land, as much as from the sea, and salted away memory, alongside which we find the most complex and mysterious of human experiences. It is a celebration of language, place, and the mystery of being alive, alive, alive. Mr. Glenday added, there's a remarkably mature intelligence at work in these profound, assured, and willfully spare poems. Roseanne Watts is a truly individual and welcome voice. Professor James McGonagall, chair of the Edwin Morgan Trust, said, not only did the number of entries increase for the third award, new and different voices from across Scotland were revealed. The judges combined diligence, sensitivity and their extensive professional experience in selecting five of these anonymous collections as worthy finalists. We are most grateful to them and to all the entrants. For more information, you can look up www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk.
Glasgow Citizens Theatre will host their first 50p ticket sale at their temporary but new home at Tramway, the arts venue in the city's south side. The tickets are for Cyrano de Bergerac, a co-production with the National Theatre of Scotland and Royal Lyceum Theatre Edinburgh. The Gorbals Theatre building is closed for a two-year redevelopment, and while it is shut, the Citizens Theatre is to present work at the nearby Tramway venue. The first performance will be Cyrano de Bergerac, which has been given a Glaswegian heart, in the new production directed by Dominic Hill. 100 tickets across 10 performances will be available from the Tramway. Customers will be able to buy a maximum of 2 tickets per person, which must be paid for in cash. Over 3.5 50p tickets have been sold since Mr. Hill revived the 50p ticket offer in his first season at the Citizens Theatre in 2012. Nominations have opened for an award that honours a teacher or librarian that has greatly influenced the reading habits of a community. The Scottish Book Trust Learning Professional Award 2019 has opened for its third year. School teachers and librarians are able to nominate inspiring colleagues who are passionate advocates of reading and writing in their place of work. Eileen Littlewood, head teacher of Fourth View Primary School in Edinburgh, received the 2018 Learning Professional Award. Mark Lambert, Chief Executive at Scottish Book Trust, said, "Teachers and librarians are the backbone of any strong reading culture in the life of young people and adults."
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know someone who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet audio player, where our podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF of a Sonata internet radio, please contact your local agent. Please note you will need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk. And remember, when setting up the player, ask for queue and review. Now, back to the main programme.
Glasgow Herald, today Wednesday 22nd August 2018. GERS, Scotland's finances in first year of independence would have been worse than previously thought. This article by Tom Gordon, Scottish political editor. Scotland's deficit was more than 4 times that of the UK last year, despite an extra £1 billion in North Sea oil income, according to latest official figures. The annual government expenditure and revenue Scotland, GERS, figures showed a deficit of £13.4 billion, or 7.9% of GDP, in 2017-18. The UK deficit was 1.9% of GDP in the same year. Public spending in Scotland was a record £1,576 higher per head than in the rest of the UK, thanks to a cross-border subsidy from the Treasury. The Scottish Tories said the black hole in the nation's finances showed why the SNP should drop any plans for another SNP referendum. The GERS figures showed Scotland's finances would have been in an even worse state than previously thought in the first year of independence had there been a yes vote in 2014. Last year, GERS said the deficit had been £13.3 billion, or 8.3% of GDP in 2016-17. However, these have now been revised to £14.5 billion and 8.9% of GDP. The White Paper on Independence, launched by Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, forecast a manageable deficit of between £2.7 billion to £5.5 billion, or 1.6% to 3.2% of GDP. The difference was due to the oil price slump after the 2014 referendum. The GERS figures also showed a record union dividend of 1,982 in 2016-17 after revisions, compared to 1,882 in 2017-18 and £952 per head in 2013-14. This is the difference between how much Scotland contributed per head to the Exchequer and received back in public spending. In 2017-18, Scotland's per capita tax revenue was £306 lower than the UK level and spending was £1,576 higher. Just 7 years ago, Scotland was a net contributor to the Treasury at £200 per head. The new data did, however, show a marked upturn in Scotland's geographical share of revenue from the North Sea, which was up from £266 million in 2016-17 to £1.3 billion. Overall, Scotland generated 8% of UK revenue last year, had 9.3% of public spending, and accounted for 34% of the UK's £39.3 billion deficit. Ms Sturgeon said the figures showed the Scottish economy was in a state of recovery, but Brexit remained a real and present danger. She highlighted growth on the onshore economy in Scotland had been faster than in the UK. The SNP's recent Growth Commission, its revised economic blueprint for independence, envisaged a one-year deficit of around 8.3% more than in 2017-18. That would suggest the trajectory is more positive in reality than the Growth Commission assumed, Ms Sturgeon said. To the dismay of many on the left of the independence movement, the Commission proposed keeping a tight rein on public spending to halve the deficit over 10 years. Ms Sturgeon said cutting the deficit was important, but not if it meant austerity. She said fiscal rules should not become counterproductive. So if actually what the economy needs is stimulus to get the economy growing faster, that's what should take priority. The Growth Commission was an explicit rejection of the kind of austerity economics we have seen in recent years. She said the 3% deficit target in the Commission was a reasonable one, but added it was important not to become so fixated on that that it becomes counterproductive. Asked if the 1,576 extra public spending per head would look fair to voters south of the border, she said it was more than fair given the history of North Sea oil receipts. Ms Sturgeon refused to apologise for the even wider gap between the official figures for the putative first year of independence and those in the White Paper. She said, "I would defy anybody to say that they foresaw what happened in the North Sea and oil revenues. That's what changed the projections." What we see here today is an improving position, as oil improves and as our onshore economy improves. Don't lose sight of the fact that onshore revenues, excluding oil and gas, are up by £2 billion. That is faster growth in onshore revenues than UK growth in onshore revenues in the same year. We have a Scottish economy that has had a difficult time in the last few years because of the position in oil, notwithstanding that we have had strong onshore growth, and we see that picture continuing here. Finance Secretary Derek Mackay added, "The latest economic data points to an improving picture in Scotland. Our economy grew twice as fast as the UK in the most recent quarter, while unemployment remains close to its record low and confidence is returning to the oil and gas sector." Overall revenue in Scotland reaching £60 billion for the first time ever, underlining the fact that we have a productive and growing economy despite the UK government's London-centric economic policies. Meanwhile, Scottish exports of goods have increased by 12% over the past year, the fastest rate of growth of any nation in the UK, with huge potential for further expansion in key overseas markets. Scottish Tory MSP Murdo Fraser said, "If Nicola Sturgeon wants to continue her threat of a second referendum, she has to explain where she would find £13 billion to fill this deficit. Assuming that can't be done, the prospect of another divisive and unwelcome vote must be removed for good so Scotland can focus on what really matters." Yet again, the union dividend has been made clear. By being part of the UK, Scotland received an extra £1,576 for every man, woman and child last year above the UK average. For a family of four, that's more than £600 in additional public spending. If Scotland was to be ripped out of the UK, this spending would be splashed drastically, meaning schools, hospitals and infrastructure would be hit. Any Scottish government would also have to massively increase taxes and borrowing to help to make up the difference, something the hard-working public simply wouldn't accept. And while Scotland's finances improved slightly on the whole last year, the rest of the UK's have done even better, meaning the gap is now bigger. Scotland Labour leader Richard Leonard said, "People across Scotland are sick and tired of austerity, and these figures show that the SNP's plans for independence would mean unprecedented levels of austerity for Scotland." The SNP's plan to close Scotland's deficit is a cuts commission, a vision which protects the interests of big corporations and the privileged few instead of our vital public services. The dividing line in Scotland is now between Labour's plan to invest and build an economy that works for many, not the few, or further austerity with the SNP and the Tories. Scottish Lib Dem leader Willie Rennie said, "These numbers are another cruel blow to the nationalists coming from their own government. It adds to the misery set out in the SNP's growth commission. Whichever way you look at it, under nationalist plans, all the good things we all want to do in Scotland would be under threat because of funding cuts. Investing in people through education and mental health would be harder under independence." Scottish Green MSP Patrick Harvey added, "Here we have another reminder that the Scottish economy is still too focused on oil and gas extraction instead of making the needed transition to clean and sustainable renewable sources of energy." While the other parties use this annual publication as justification for how Scotland couldn't be a small, successful, independent country, or how great the SNP government thinks it is, they'd do well to remember that both our prosperity and our climate depends on moving to a clean economy. Professor Graham Roy, director of the Fraser of Allender think tank, said, "GERS takes the current constitutional settlement as given. If the very purpose of independence is to take different choices about the type of economy and society that we live in, then a set of accounts based upon the world today will tell us little about the long-term finances of an independent Scotland. But GERS does provide a pretty accurate picture of where Scotland is in 2018. So in doing so, today's numbers set the starting point for a discussion about the immediate choices and challenges that need to be addressed by those advocating new fiscal arrangements." Mike Tholen of Oil and Gas UK said, "The GERS data showed a striking transformation of the UK and oil gas industry since the downturn." He said, "Improvements to operational efficiency, careful management of the costs and a stable fiscal regime have ensured it is better placed to weather volatility in international oil markets. This golden formula must now be maintained as we look to maximise economic recovery." This article by Tom Gordon. Glasgow Herald, Tuesday 21st August. Very Scottish Suleiman Coulibaly comes home sweet home with Partick Thistle. Suleiman Coulibaly has insisted he feels right at home in Scotland after he penned a one-year deal with Partick Thistle. The Jags have snapped up the striker following a trial at the club after he endured an unhappy stint in Egypt with Al Ahly last year. The 23-year-old earned that move due to an impressive spell with Kilmarnock, where he netted 11 times in 26 appearances two seasons ago. And the former Ivory Coast under-17 internationalist, who also spent time down south with Tottenham Hotspur and Peterborough United, is determined to recapture that form after sealing his move to Firhill. He said, "I'm very pleased to sign here. I was at home with my family when my agent phoned to say I had an opportunity with Partick, and I just took the opportunity right away. I know Scotland. I consider it my country because my small boy was born here in Kilmarnock, so I'm very Scottish. Not my accent, but I'm happy to be here personally, and I'm looking forward to starting the season strongly." Coulibaly became an instant fans' favourite after joining Kilmarnock in 2016 and earned the Rugby Park outfit a reported £800,000 when he made the ill-fated switch to Al Ahly. But he claimed he did not feel safe in Egypt and left under a cloud last summer, just 6 months into his 3.5-year deal. Ahead of a possible debut away to Dundee United this weekend, he added to Jagzone, "Scotland is like home because when I was here, the people were happy and they loved football. Even if you lose the game, they are fine with you if you have given 100%. I like that. I'm happy to be here and I hope to make the fans happy. I've already told the manager I'm ready to play. Mentally I'm ready, and if I am mentally ready, that means my body is ready." This article is unattributed.
That's the end of part one. After the break, we'll be coming back with more great articles from the Herald Scotland. Welcome back. The headlines in part two. Business HQ. Why be afraid of doing the right thing?
Universal basic income is an attempt to euthanize the working class as a concept.
Get ready for more inanities from the nonentities.
Call for urgent social care overhaul, as only 1 in 10 putting aside cash for care in old age.
Angela Haggerty. Image of convicted sex offender should be removed from Glasgow subway station mural. Universal basic income is attempt to euthanise the working class as a concept.
Article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 23rd of August. Business. Investors downbeat on Brexit effect on wealth. This article by Ian McConnell, Group Business Editor.
GERS, Business Welcomes Signs of Oil Recovery, by Tom Gordon, Scottish Political Editor.
James Milner, Brendan Rodgers is a better manager than when he was at Liverpool. He'll make sure Celtic bounce back. An article by Matthew Lindsay, Chief Football Writer.
Starving Perth teen Caitlin White, with vomiting disorder, warned even drip feeding could kill her.
The Herald Scotland, on Monday, the 20th of August 2018. Business HQ. Why be afraid of doing the right thing? This article by Ivor Tiefenbrunn. The campaign against Brexit is stupefyingly alarmist. The bulk of our trade is with countries outwith the protectionist EU trade zone. This trade has been expanding since we joined the EU, and while our trade with the EU has diminished, our trade deficit with the EU has increased enormously. They now sell twice as much to us as we to them. While Britain plays fairly under EU rules, EU countries have contrived to preclude British companies from winning significant projects across the EU. Many British companies can sell successfully in the Americas and Far East against EU competitors, but strangely never win contracts in EU member states, not even from Ireland, our closest neighbour. We've always treated the Irish with incredible honesty and decency since they left our union, and yet they are dictating the terms of our leaving the EU on an unreasonable and irrational basis, accompanied by absurd threats of closing their airspace to the UK, despite their dependency on our friendship and support, and access to our airspace, ports, and market. The latest Brexit scaremongering includes the suggestion that we will get more drug-resistant, sexually transmitted diseases after we leave the EU. Many will look forward to the prospect of increased sex with enthusiasm. Others will find this ridiculous claim as absurd as the threatening pronouncements and discredited forecasts of the Governor and Bank of England. The latest anti-democratic attempt to undo the referendum result has prompted the claim that drugs are being stockpiled because their supply will be interrupted by Brexit. It might not occur to most people that the companies who are claiming to be stockpiling drugs are based in the EU and are stockpiling their medicines in the UK. There are few, if any, drugs which are manufactured exclusively in the EU, and clearly, if there was any interruption to supply, EU drug manufacturers would lose their market share to their competitors based in America, Canada, India, the Far East and elsewhere, especially to lower-cost generic drug manufacturers. There's no conceivable reason why Britain would impede the importation of pharmaceutical drugs from the EU, whatever the terms of Brexit, so people should consider the likely motives for these alarmist pronouncements. Some things are just too simple for people to understand. Brexit under WTO terms is the most advantageous outcome for the United Kingdom. The hysterical scaremongering of vested interest groups confirms this to be the case. Let us hope that the desperate EU negotiators, confused British government and the conflicted Parliament do not fudge the issue of implementing the result of this democratic referendum. We are far better off trading on WTO terms outside the EU than within it on any restrictive basis that compromises our ability to engage in genuine free trade with the rest of the world, or more importantly, undermines our democratic referendum decision, our legal and economic independence, or our historic freedoms. Donald Trump had a recent confrontation over trade tariffs in Montreal. To the horror of the other G7 members, he suggested that the simplest way to resolve their dispute would be to abolish all trade barriers and tariffs. The alarm and instantaneous rejection of this solution makes it clear that the EU, Japan, and Canada are more interested in protecting their vested political interests than trading on a free and open competitive basis. Donald Trump is vilified, among many other things, for his criticism of rigged and protectionist trade deals. But the examples of New Zealand, Singapore and Hong Kong make it clear that even the most smallest economies can flourish the most when they remove protective tariff barriers and embrace free trade, as opposed to the EU's protectionist trade policies which work against the interests of the EU public and indeed people across the world. Acting rationally in an unpredictable world depends on improving the signal-to-noise ratio enough to discern what's true and obvious, and to be confident that disregarding meaningless noise is the best way to get the right result. Ivor Tiefenbrunn is a Scottish manufacturer. This article was by Ivor Tiefenbrunn.
This is an article from the Herald, written by political correspondent Alistair Grant. Universal basic income is an attempt to euthanise the working class as a concept. Proposals to hand everyone in Scotland a basic flat rate income are an attempt to euthanise the working class as a political concept, a think tank director has said. Tom Kivasi, director of Left Wing Institute for Public Policy Research, insisted the scheme was to the UK's economic problems what snake oil is to medicine. He urged it would mean getting into bed with the billionaires by letting capitalism off the hook and entrenching power inequalities. It comes after Nicola Sturgeon pledged to fund research into a universal basic income UBI last year, with £250,000 set aside for potential pilots in four council areas. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell has also said pilots could be included in the next Labour mass investor. Mr. Kavisi was debating the issue at the Edinburgh International Book Festival with economist and basic income campaigner Annie Miller and economist and journal Stuart Lanzi. Miss Miller, co-founder of Citizens Basic Income Network Scotland, suggested every adult could be paid £162 a week. This would be funded by hiking income tax at least 45%. The APPR previously said such a scheme would cost £20 billion a year in Scotland and would risk making child poverty worse. A green economy is in crisis and in need of a fundamental reform. Mr. Kavisi said a basic income was seductive, precisely because it's a big idea, but the problem is that big ideas aren't necessarily good ideas. He added, "My real objection to the UBI is that it lets capitalism off the hook. It has given in, it is embracing defeat." He said the policy was widely supported by Silicon Valley tycoons such as Elon Musk, former Google chairman Eric Schmidt, and Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, as well as Richard Branson. He continued, "In politics, you always get strange bedfellows. That's absolutely the case. But if you're going to get in bed with billionaires, you've got to ask yourself, why they're in favour of it. The reason is that UBI actually maintains unequal power relations." He said introducing a basic income risked leaving 20 or 30% of the population as a dependent class, and insisted it was trying to attempt a form of kind of refusalism for the working class as a potential category and a political concept. Dismissing the idea as magical thinking, he urged money should be insisted be spent upon building good homes, boosting the budget of NHS or improving schools. He also insisted UBI would subtly and reinforce gender inequality because women would come under pressure to stay home and look after children. He added, "UBI is to our economic problems what snake oil is to medicine." Glasgow, Edinburgh, Fife, North Ayrshire councils are all considering basic income pilots. The They'll be ready to begin their trials on March 2020, subject to final decision on whether or not the proposal are feasible. Supporters deny the scheme is being held up as a silver bullet that will solve all of society's problems. Ms Miller said UBI would help enslave people and prevent poverty, and branded the social current security system very cruel. But she said it would need to be introduced gradually to prevent disruption and allow the system to settle in. She said UBI would live up for 4 weeks engraved on a mace in the Scottish Parliament, justice, integrity, compassion and wisdom. I can't think of a better foundation for society than a better income, bringing about some of these, and I hope it will happen, she added. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "We are interested in any proposals to help reduce poverty and inequality. We have awarded £250,000 over the next 2 years to 4 local authorities developing work that seeks to better understand the impact of citizens' basic income, including costs, benefits and savings." This was an article written by political correspondent Alistair Grant.
Remember, this programme is just a fraction of what we produce. You can access more daily content online via our website, qnreview.com/freepodcasts. For free daily podcasts of the Evening Times and Herald Scotland newspapers, weekly digests of the National newspaper, and weekly full readings of Inside Soap magazine. Now, back to the main programme.
Article from Herald Scotland, 21st of August 2018, Opinion. Robert McNeill, "Get ready for more inanities from the nonentities." As I write, the UK leader, Gerald Corbyn, is somewhere in my country, practising his soundbites and cephalological wheezes. I hope for his sake that he does better than previously, when he seemed not to know that Scotland had its own legal system and promised to implement a raft of policies that the SNP had already implemented. It was a classic case of metrosplaining, where lackadaisical luminaries from the southern metropolis failed to do their homework before venturing north to tell us about our country. The weekend also saw a selection of top nonentities coming here to try to persuade us that we were better off in Europe. This in a country that had already voted massively to remain. Worse still, this collection of glassy-eyed galoots from the People's Vote campaign were composed almost entirely of the same people who told us in 2014 that voting no was the only way to ensure we stayed in the EU and that voting yes would see us forced to leave it. Not only that, but they believe in the United Kingdom as a whole, where the people's vote was to leave. It's the new trope of our times, selective democracy, and we in Scotland are just as guilty of it. Here's the trouble with referenda. People want to have them every 5 minutes till they get the result they want. In a proper democracy, the Queen would declare that referendum results should be binding for at least 10 years. That would save all the agonising about whether to have another one now. No. Someone ill-advisedly mentioned nonentities earlier, but at least that didn't apply to the comedian Rory Bremner, who got into a Twitter spat with nationalists over the injudicious people's wrong vote visit. This never descended to abuse, though several contributors wearily feared it would be spun as such in the press, where abuse is a much abused word. But it was rather robust, and Rory, to his credit, did his best to appear conciliatory and pleasant. The trouble with the unionist case is that it's always easily outwitted intellectually. It's nothing more than a feeling, and I can respect it for that, as well as understanding that it's why it attracts the kind of brain surgeons who turned out with their union flags and Ulster paraphernalia on Glasgow's George Square after the independence referendum vote in 2014. Talking of leading intellectuals, another imminent visitor to Lesser Britain looks like being top-to-bottom Brexiter Nigel Farage, pronounced Farage if you're British, rather than the French way in which he says it. He's campaigning to take our country back, which is what we tried to do in 2014, despite his opposition. And yesterday he got into first gear on a purple double-deck bus, boasting, in his words, the biggest drinks cabinet in the country. Well, that should come in handy and save him having to take refuge in a pub, as he did on his last visit here when he was given the two fingers, veni, vidi, vicis, and found himself pursued by an angry mob. I don't approve of this kind of thing, and as a socialist, deplore these left-wing anti-fascist mobs who behave like fascists, shutting down free speech and bringing mayhem to the streets. Bringing your politics to the street is fine, as long as it remains civilised. The recent all-under-one-banner marches for independence have been a shining example of this. But as soon as you have a situation where you can't have kids and pet dogs present on safety grounds, I never want to be a part of it. As for Nigel, he's quite likeable in some ways. Sorry, but a man holding a pint always brings out a twinge of solidarity in me. We should do ourselves a favour, be good-natured about it all, and let him have his say. Unfortunately, the last time he was here, he chose to say the protesters were anti-English SNP supporters, which was inaccurate on so many levels. The protesters were mostly a wide range of students, and one of the two arrested leaders was English. That's the problem with trying to smear the SNP as anti-English. It displays risible ignorance. Despite English votes playing a part in swinging the vote against Scottish independence in 2014, the party is so painfully pro-English that you would risk defenestration if you even mentioned the E-word in front of it. Which brings us back to Mr. Corbyn, who is here under a distinctly nationalist-sounding Build It in Britain banner, which might have been borrowed from Donald Trump and could even meet Nigel's approval. Truly, we live in interesting times. I wish we didn't.
The Herald Scotland. News. Recorded on the 20th of August, 2018. Call for urgent social care overhaul as only 1 in 10 putting aside cash for care in old age. By health correspondent, Helen McCarty. Only 1 in 10 adults aged 55 and over are putting aside money to help pay for care in old age, it has emerged. Amid fresh warnings of the UK's broken social care system. Research by consumer champions Which warned that any funding model which relies on individuals to bankroll their own social care is doomed to fail. They found that only 12% of people over 55 had set aside cash to pay for care home costs, with 55% admitting they were prioritising other things they want or need to do now over planning for care. However, the vast majority of the 2,100 respondents said that they would be willing to pay for adaptations to their home, such as ramps or handrails, to enable them to live in their own home for longer, and 85% said they would consider hiring a cleaner, gardener, or handy person if they could afford it. The survey also found that most people faced with sourcing social care provision for themselves or a relative would turn to Google first before seeking advice from a GP or family. Alex Heyman, Which Managing Director of Public Markets, said, "The broken social care system cannot continue to fail older people and their families in delivering high-quality, affordable care when they most need support. The government must recognise that most people won't have made extensive plans for their care, so the system must be designed to help people get the support they need at a time of crisis and stress for themselves and their loved ones." It comes after reports that the Treasury will be asked to draw up plans for our care ISA, which would enable people to save tax-free towards social care while protecting their savings from inheritance tax. The proposals would be unveiled in the UK government's forthcoming Green Paper on Social Care for England, although a spokeswoman for the Treasury stressed that it was not a Treasury policy and not something being worked on at present. It is also unclear whether care ISAs would be available to Scottish investors, since social care is devolved, but most tax policy is not. ISAs are currently taxed at death, which is said to give people the perverse incentive to spend money they may need for end-of-life care. At present, anyone with capital worth more than £27,250, for example, property or savings, must pay their own care home bill. Below that threshold, residents will pay a portion of the fees until a cut-off at £17,000, after which the full cost is picked up by councils. In Scotland, the elderly are also entitled to free personal care, which covers costs such as bathing and having meals prepared, both in care homes and in their own home. However, there have been accusations that better-off care home residents are unfairly propping up the system by paying much higher fees than council-funded residents in the same home. It also emerged in June that 15,000 Scots are in debt to social care providers and 11 were taken to court over unpaid charges last year. It comes as cash-strapped local authorities have increased fees for non-residential care or introduced new levies for services such as attending a day centre, telecare monitoring, sheltered housing and shopping services. Dr. Donald McCaskill, CEO of Scottish Care, the umbrella body for independent care providers, said, "In order to maximise the benefits of having people live longer, to build on the potential of health and social care integration, and to address the crisis in social care service sustainability, we need to start urgently to plan for our future." The Witch Report, highlighting the lack of planning people make for their future and the potential of a care ISA south of the border, add even greater urgency to this debate. If we are to continue to have and to further develop high-quality rights-based care for all our older citizens in Scotland, then we need to start planning. The alternative is to sleepwalk into a future where those who can afford to will purchase high-quality care and those who cannot will be left with a poorly funded, resource-drained, lesser alternative. A Scottish Government spokeswoman said, "In Scotland, we are fully committed to providing free personal care, currently for those aged 65 and over, with this extending to those under 65 from the 1st of April 2019. In 2018/19, we're giving an additional £66 million to local government to support implementation of the Carers Scotland Act, maintaining payment of the real living wage and increasing payments for free personal and nursing care." By health correspondent Helen McCarty.
Here at Q&A Review, we're always looking for more volunteer presenters, producers and sound technicians to volunteer with us and help produce our daily talking newspapers for the blind. If you're interested, please leave a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976 or email us at information@qandreview.com. The Herald Scotland. On Wednesday, the 22nd of August 2018. Opinion section. Angela Haggerty. Image of convicted sex offender should be removed from Glasgow subway station mural. This article by Angela Haggerty. There's a stunning new mural nearing completion in Glasgow. Scaling the full height of a building in the city's high street, the artist Smug has created a beautiful depiction of St Enoch cradling her baby, St Mungo, and there's something quite breathtaking about the towering tenderness of the image. It's a beautiful idea. St Enoch is the mother of St Mungo, the patron saint of Glasgow, and the legend of St Enoch tells a story befitting a city which has radical political undercurrent running through its people, with social justice at its heart. While we refer to her as St Enoch, legend tells the story of a woman named Tani, or Tani, or Tonya, it's not clear which is correct, in the 6th century, who became pregnant after being raped. Upon hearing the news, her father attempted to kill her by having her thrown from a great height, but she miraculously survived and gave birth to Kentigern, later St Mungo. When she later died, it's said that the site of St Enoch Square in Glasgow city centre is where she was buried. Smug's mural gives me goosebumps in a world where sexual violence and shame are still so frighteningly prevalent. It gently screams strength, and it's a wonderful thing to see. However, for all the great and good of this city and its people, it has its embarrassing moments too. Contrast the St Enoch mural this week with the news that another piece of work across the city has sparked some controversy and apparently a momentary lapse of reason in its designer, Alistair Gray. Hillhead Subway Station hosts the mural in question, which happens to feature 54-year-old former North Lanarkshire councillor David Fagan, a man who has since been convicted of sex offences. Fagan was caught after confessing to an undercover police officer, who was posing as a mother of three children, that he fantasised about incest and child abuse. It's horrifying stuff. Glasgow Kelvin MSP Sandra White, who's also depicted in the mural, has been calling for changes to be made to it, saying, "The work was commissioned by the Strathclyde Partnership for Transport, SPT, is owned by the public and should be removed or adjusted." Lanark author Gray, however, appears to disagree on a point of practicality. "Someone asked at the time, I think it was Sandra White, for action to be taken, and I said I don't think anything should be done about it," he said. "SPT asked me and I told them the same. No one need know about it and I don't intend publicising it. I don't want anything done about it. If you had to go around changing everything connected to a controversial person, there'd be nothing left in galleries." While I understand where Gray is coming from with these points, I think he's calling it wrong on this occasion. There has been an at times intense public debate cropping up in recent years about art and monuments depicting history's controversial characters and whether or not they should be removed from public consumption to avoid the risk of glorifying unsavoury behaviour. Arguably, this debate has taken a more frantic turn since the global upheavals of Brexit, the election of American President Donald Trump, and the rise of the far right across Europe. There's a deep fear that the darkness of history is somehow being forgotten and that past tyrants have taken on fresh appeal. However, the solution to society forgetting the horrors of the past is hardly to remove reference to them. When it comes to public monuments in particular, it may cause deep discomfort to see controversial historical figures, such as pro-slavery figures in the United States, whose statues became part of a removal campaign last year, given such a permanent elevated status. However, rather than tearing such things down, a more enduring response would be to push for a similar nod for other historical figures, to make sure the whole story is told and publicly documented. This is relevant for public figures who had a material impact in the course of history and culture, but it doesn't apply to people like Fagin, who simply don't deserve a place on a publicly funded modern mural. He's a convicted sex offender. I hope Gray will have a change of heart and find a way to make a meaningful change to his subway creation. He's a highly respected figure in Scotland, and while his stance on this is rooted in an understandable point of principle, in this case he should allow it to be overridden by a gesture for the public good. Fagin will probably fade away in history, with few people remembering his role of public life, but the same can't be said of someone of Gray's stature. And not too far away from Gray's artwork is that powerful, magnificent mural of St Enoch, which celebrates the character of an incredible legend, and which projects the strength of survival rather than the cowardice of a character like Fagin. Glasgow encompasses a strong spirit for the downtrodden. A small change from Gray would make a big statement. This article was by Angela Haggerty. The Herald Scotland, on Friday, the 17th of August 2018. News. Universal basic income is attempt to euthanise the working class as a concept. This article by Alistair Grant, political correspondent. Proposals to hand everyone in Scotland a basic flat rate income are an attempt to euthanise the working class as a political concept, a think tank director has said. Tom Kibasi, director of the left-wing Institute for Public Policy Research, IPPR, insisted the scheme was to the UK's economic problems what snake oil is to medicine. He argued it would mean getting into bed with the billionaires by letting capitalism off the hook and entrenching power inequalities. It comes after Nicola Sturgeon pledged to fund research into a universal basic income, UBI, last year, with £250,000 set aside for potential pilots in four council areas. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell has also said pilots should be included in the next Labour manifesto. Mr Kibas was debating the issue at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, with economist and basic income campaigner Annie Miller and economist and journalist Stuart Lanzi. Ms Miller, co-founder of Citizens Basic Income Network Scotland, suggested that every adult could be paid £162 a week, and this would be funded by hiking income tax to at least 45%. The IPPR previously said such a scheme would cost £20 billion a year in Scotland and would risk making child poverty worse. Agreeing the economy is in crisis and in need of fundamental reform, Mr Kibas said a basic income was seductive precisely because it's a big idea. The problem is that big ideas aren't necessarily good ideas. He added, "My real objection to UBI is that it lets capitalism off the hook. It's giving in, it's embracing defeat." He said the policy was widely supported by Silicon Valley tycoons such as Elon Musk, former Google chairman Eric Schmidt, and Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, as well as Richard Branson. He continued, "In politics you always get strange bedfellows, and that's absolutely the case. But if you're going to get into bed with the billionaires, you've got to ask yourself, why are they in favour of it? The reason is that UBI actually maintains unequal power relations." He said introducing a basic income risked leaving 20 or 30% of the population as a dependent class, and insisted it was trying to attempt a form of a kind of euthanasia for the working class as a political category and political concept. Dismissing the idea as magical thinking, he argued money should instead be spent on building good homes, boosting the budget of the NHS, or improving schools. He also insisted UBI would solidify and reinforce gender inequality because women would come under pressure to stay at home and look after their children. He added, "UBI is to our economic problems what snake oil is to medicine." Glasgow, Edinburgh, Fife and North Ayrshire councils are all considering basic income pilots. They'll be ready to begin their trials in March 2020, subject to a final decision on whether or not the proposals are feasible. Supporters deny the scheme is being held up as a silver bullet that will solve all of society's problems. Ms Miller said UBI would help emancipate people and prevent poverty, and branded the current social security system very cruel. But she said it would need to be introduced gradually to prevent disruption and allow the system to settle in. She said UBI would live up to the four words engraved on the mace in the Scottish Parliament: justice, integrity, compassion and wisdom. "I can't think of a better foundation for a society than a basic income. bringing about some of these changes that I hope will happen, she added. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "We're interested in any proposals to help reduce poverty and inequality. We've awarded £250,000 over the next 2 years to four local authorities, developing work that seeks to better understand the impact of citizens' basic income, including costs, benefits and savings." This article was by Alistair Grant, political correspondent.
Article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 23rd of August. Business. Investors downbeat on Brexit effect on wealth. This article by Ian McConnell, Group Business Editor. 13 million UK investors, 44% of the total number, believe Brexit will not make them wealthier, while only 19% think it will, our survey signals. Meanwhile, 14.5 million UK investors, around half, believe their wealth has not increased since the vote in June 2016 to leave the European Union. Only about 5.5 million believe their wealth has increased since the referendum, according to the survey from the Enterprise Investment Scheme Association. And 17 million UK investors do not think the Westminster government is doing a good job in securing a deal for the country's financial services sector, with 59% of respondents to the survey expressing such a view. The figures are based on research conducted across a sample of 2,007 respondents. Asked if they felt there would be a Brexit deficit, which would make the UK poorer after the March 2019 date set for leaving the EU, 45% of respondents, equivalent to 13 million investors, believed there would be, while 27% did not think this would be the case. Mark Brownridge, Director General of the Enterprise Investment Scheme Association, said, "It is clear that from this research that British investors feel that Brexit has not made them wealthier to date, and they do not believe that it will in the future either." He added, "Moreover, they feel that our government does not have their back and, in fact, is contributing to the negative sentiment surrounding Brexit. The fact that so many investors feel this way is going to have a knock-on impact on the rest of the country and the economy."
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 23rd August 2018. GERS, Business Welcomes Signs of Oil Recovery, by Tom Gordon, Scottish Political Editor. Business leaders have welcomed signs of improvement contained in the GERS report. CBI Scotland Director Tracy Black said they showed the public finances continued to move in the right direction, thanks in large part to higher oil prices helping the North Sea industry. Scotland's estimated geographical share of North Sea receipts rose from £266 million to £1.3 billion last year. However, there were also concerns about the high Scottish deficit. She said Scotland still has room to improve its fiscal deficit compared with the UK as a whole. Only by supporting the private sector to grow the Scottish economy can we deliver the sustainable public services we all want for Scotland. Against a backdrop of Brexit uncertainty, we need a relentless focus on the fundamentals, boosting productivity and safeguarding Scotland's competitiveness. Mike Tholen of Oil and Gas said the increase in Scotland's geographical share of North Sea receipts from £266 million to £1.33 billion showed a striking transformation since the price downturn. He said improvements to the operational efficiency, careful management of costs and a stable fiscal regime have ensured it is better placed to weather volatility in international oil markets. This golden formula must now be maintained as we look to maximise economic recovery. Scottish Chambers of Commerce Chief Executive Liz Cameron said GERS painted a mixed picture with positive signs in oil, but a fiscal position more challenging than the UK's. She said the Scottish and UK governments both have a part to play in ensuring continued stability for oil and gas firms, and investment must continue in the vital infrastructure required to streamline access to markets for businesses. Governments must do all they can in partnership with the private sector to encourage small and medium-sized firms to export and trade with businesses across the world. This will further bolster the economy against domestic shocks and boost our ability to maintain sustainable growth and tackle the fiscal deficit in the long term. Julian Martin, SNP MSP for Aberdeenshire East, said there was growing confidence in the North East, with oil production expected to be 20% higher this year than in 2014. She said the North Sea looks set once again on an upward trajectory. However, we cannot be complacent. With up to 20 billion barrels of oil left, the Tory government must use its powers to stimulate exploration and investment and ensure our oil and gas sector can capitalise on a decommissioning market that is forecast to reach £17 billion. It is the least they can do. The Scottish Green MSP Patrick Harvey said GERS was a reminder of Scotland's over-reliance on oil and gas extraction when a transition to clean, renewable energy was needed. He said while other parties use this annual publication as justification for how Scotland couldn't be a small, successful, independent country, or how great the SNP government thinks it is, they'd do well to remember that both our prosperity and our climate depend on moving to a clean economy. Former Tory MEP Struan Stevenson, now Chief Executive of Scottish Business UK, added, while the figures do show some improvement in Scotland's finances, thanks to a small recovery in North Sea oil, it's increasingly clear this one commodity cannot be relied upon to deliver stable returns each year. Scottish business needs a level of certainty, and these figures are a stark reminder of the uncertain future which lies ahead if the proponents of independence continue to gamble with Scottish economy.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know someone who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet audio player, where our podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF of a Sonata internet radio, please contact your local agent. Please note you will need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk. And remember, when setting up the player, ask for queue and review. Now, back to the main programme.
James Milner. Brendan Rodgers is a better manager than when he was at Liverpool. He'll make sure Celtic bounce back. An article by Matthew Lindsay, chief football writer, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 21st of August 2018. James Milner today insisted that Brendan Rodgers is a better manager now than when he led Liverpool to the brink of their first English title in 24 years back in 2014. And the England midfielder has predicted the Northern Irishman will ensure Celtic bounce back from their Champions League exit by clinching a place in the Europa League group stages. Rodgers came in for fierce criticism last week following his side's aggregate defeat to AEK Athens in the third qualifying round of Europe's Premier Club competition. But Milner, who Rodgers signed for Liverpool in 2015, feels there is no disgrace in failing to successfully negotiate four qualifying rounds. And he is confident his old boss will recover from that setback immediately by overcoming FK Suduva in the Europa League playoff. The 61 times capped player feels his former manager's time at Anfield, where he was sacked after just over three seasons in charge, will prove invaluable during this difficult spell. Brendan did well at Anfield and he came so close to ending that long wait for the title, said Milner. He'll be a better manager now for his experience at Liverpool. The success he's had in Scotland suggests that. Brendan did a good job at Liverpool and he's doing a good job at Parkhead. Liverpool's loss has been Celtic's gain. He came here and he's won every trophy so far. He hasn't lost a cup tie since he came to Celtic, which which is ridiculous. No matter what level you're playing at, that takes some doing. Milner added, the Champions League is very tough, especially when you factor in the number of games Celtic need to play just to reach the groups. I've played in qualifiers before and people see some of the teams involved with players they've never heard of and they think it's going to be easy. But it hardly ever works out that way. You find that they're in the qualifiers for a reason. They might not have the same exposure as the clubs from the biggest countries, but these are hard ties, especially because they come so early in the season. All the hard work you've done the year before to get into a position to get into the Champions League qualifiers can be thrown away in a two-legged game. It's tough. European football is obviously important to a club like Celtic. I'm sure they'll be pushing hard to get into the Europa League group stages. That's a great competition as well. Unfortunately, I lost to Seville in the final with Liverpool. Thinking about not winning that European trophy still hurts. There's quality in the Europa League from the start, even before the clubs from the Champions League drop in. It's a very good tournament to do well in. James Milner will be playing for a Liverpool legend side against a Celtic greats team in A Match for Cancer, which will take place at Celtic Park on Saturday, September the 8th. Tickets are now on sale, priced £14 for adults and £6 for concessions.
The Herald Scotland. News. Recorded on the 20th of August 2018. Starving Perth teen Caitlin White with vomiting disorder warned even drip feeding could kill her. By health correspondent Helen McCarty. It is an ultimate catch-22 where either choice could prove fatal. Caitlin White, a 19-year-old with a rare gut condition which causes her to throw up more than 30 times a day, has been told that artificial feeding may kill her, but without it she also faces potentially deadly organ failure. The teenager, from Perth, is now desperate for help from gastroenterology experts anywhere in the world as she faces up to a seemingly hopeless dilemma over her future treatment. Ms. White, who is 5'5" but weighs just 6 stone, survives on high-calorie soup, gels and powders as a result of gastroparesis, a painful condition which means her stomach is partially paralysed. It has led her to develop cyclical vomiting syndrome, meaning she is often sick more than 30 times a day and was forced to have 6 teeth extracted earlier this month as a result of acid damage. Extreme constipation, 6 to 7 weeks can elapse between bowel movements, has also led to a build-up of bacteria in her small intestine that has ravaged her immune system, and she has suffered a string of sepsis infections. In April, Scotland's chief medical officer, Dr. Catherine Calderwood, intervened in Ms. White's case to instruct that NHS Tayside refer the teenager to another specialist in Glasgow amid concerns over her care. However, she said she feels in limbo after the Glasgow consultant, Dr. Ruth McKee, warned that she was at extremely high risk of complications, including death. If doctors attempt to feed her using total parenteral nutrition, TPN, where nutrients including glucose, salts, amino acids, fat molecules, vitamins and minerals are directly pumped into a person's bloodstream via a drip. A previous line inserted at Ninewells Hospital in Dundee in March 2015 led Ms. White to develop the potentially deadly blood infection, septicemia. Dr. McKee warned that attempting TPN again could result in life-threatening complications, including chronic liver failure and blood clots on the brain, and stressed that it should only be trialled for a set period and suspended if the number of infections exceeded a predetermined amount. However, Ms. White, who weighed 11 stone before falling ill aged 14, was also warned that lack of nutrition is jeopardising her immune system. She said, "You have to weigh up the risks, but effectively my organs could go into failure without giving me TPN. The risks of doing nothing are that my immune system is weakened from lack of nutrition and my liver, kidneys and heart could be affected further than they already are in the long term. I will require longer hospital visits than I already do every day, and if the vomiting continues I will have lost all of my teeth by this time next year." Ms. White was previously an inpatient at Ninewells Hospital in Dundee for 10 months, but numerous attempts to insert feeding tubes directly into her stomach and bowel failed due to her constant vomiting and a condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which means Ms. White's muscles are abnormally slack. However, relations between Ms. White and her family and her gastroenterology team at Ninewells broke down when staff claimed Ms. White was sabotaging her treatment by dislodging the tubes on purpose, something she strongly refutes. Her grandmother, who she lives with, was left furious when nurses implied Ms. White had an eating disorder and that her agonising stomach cramps were phantom pains. Despite a private gastroenterologist telling the family that it was one of the worst cases of gastroparesis he had ever seen. Ms. White was eventually discharged from Nine Wells in June 2015 and since then has spent 8 to 9 hours a day as an outpatient at Perth Royal Infirmary, receiving infusions of potassium, magnesium, iron and phosphate to keep her alive. Despite the risks, Miss White says she will be willing to try TPN again, but not at Ninewells. She says she has lost faith in consultants there and has had no medical input from the gastroenterology team for 3 years. However, a spokeswoman for NHS Tayside said PRI lacks the expertise needed to deliver the treatment. She said, "The multidisciplinary expertise required for long-term parental nutrition exists on the specialist gastroenterology ward at Ninewells Hospital and does not exist elsewhere in NHS Tayside." The spokeswoman added that while the health board could not comment on individual cases, it was committed to delivering effective, safe healthcare to patients in an appropriate environment with the necessary expertise from staff. Ms. White said she has written to experts in gut health all over the world and hopes someone might be able to help. "My condition is so complex, unfortunately, but there must be someone willing to take it on, or there must be a way around them giving me TPN," she said. "I've been reading a lot about gut motility disorders, and there are people in Europe and the US with the expertise to take on conditions like this, but whether or not that would be an avenue to go down, I don't know. I don't know what else to do, and I don't think anyone else does, to be honest. My hope from speaking out is that someone knows something about it or could offer help." By health correspondent, Helen McCardy.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of The Herald Scotland. This weekly Talking Newspaper Digest was a Q&A Review recording service production. The readers were volunteers at Q&A Review, and the producer was Jordan Duncan. Q&A Review Recording Service Limited is a registered Scottish charity. Number SC018016. Our registered office is at 18 Crowhill Road, Bishop Briggs, Glasgow, G641QY. Remember, you can always get in contact with us by email at information@qandreview.com or by leaving us a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976.